You're listening to the Jason Greger Show, presented by PlayAlberta.ca. Play in Alberta, everything stays in Alberta. Revenues from Play Alberta stay in the province. You can help get the Henday built. And Kevin Stewart Skinner just continues to play well for the Edmonton Oilers. And they have a three-day break. They play the Kings and then 2 days, and then they play Vegas. I'm definitely playing Skinner on Wednesday. I'm not anointing him the guaranteed lock starter, but right now I would run with him for a little bit. What would you do if you were Jay Woodcroft?
Well, it's a tough one, right? Because he's clearly the better of the two goaltenders right now. And yet you need to get the other guy up and running. And as I've talked about, you know, a lot of times since that deal was signed, you know, this is a goalie who is not a technician. A goaltender who can probably find some things in his game through practice and through work with the goalie coach, but that's never going to be the foundation of his game. Maybe he can change that. You know, maybe with some of those tweaks technically and grinding through, you know, little changes here and there in practice, maybe you can make improvements. But he's largely a guy who throughout his career has played with a lot of feel, a lot of reliance on rhythm, a lot of reliance on timing. You know, I don't think it's a coincidence that the career started to take off in Toronto, where he kind of worked his way back up to opportunities to play a lot. And so that's a bit of the challenge. I don't know that you can go, like, for sure Skinner, in my mind, from the outside, looks like he's the guy that earned that start on Wednesday. But I don't know that Jack Campbell's a play once a week or every 10 game guy. Obviously, when you've got him signed to a five-year deal, that's not what you had in mind. But I don't know if you give him his best chance to play his way out of this, if that's the approach you take. And yet, you know, if it truly is a meritocracy, Skinner's earned it to this point. So it's a bit of a tough decision. It's one that I think they'll wisely consult their goaltending coach on. This is a win-now business, and yet you have to keep a bit of a long-term mindset in place as well. You don't want to completely, you know, lose a guy who seems to play so much on emotion and feeling. And as positive as he is, even when he's on the bench, it's hard to maintain that when you don't get reps.
But at some point, you got to earn them. And sometimes, I know guys, they need a week of, you know, time. Like today, they didn't practice, so they'll have Tuesday practice. Then they'll have a Thursday, Friday, right? And then you can go on the road trip. There's no back-to-back games. They play some tough teams over the next few weeks. A pretty light schedule, really. I think they only play six games over the next like 14 or 15 days. So, you know, you can sprinkle them in, but you know, a lot. Like we had Devan Dubnyk on the rundown, and he just talked about so much of it's a mental game that you just need to reset. And I thought Campbell maybe had reset after the Tampa game. He played pretty well, but then against Carolina on Thursday, he was right back in the ditch.
Yeah, and a bit of a tough, you know, like a bit of a tough road trip as well in terms of just the quality of opponents. I actually thought the Carolina game would be one that was good for him, as they're a team that has a tendency, like there are teams in this league that are not throw pucks at the net anymore.
They
like
are.
There's more and more teams going to hold, make sure the chances you take are good chances, don't waste pucks. And Carolina's a little more the other way, and I thought it might be a good opportunity for him to just see a high volume, get a good feel, and you know, obviously it didn't go that way. So, like, you're right. Like, it's a tough balance. You got to go with the guy who gives you the best chance to win, and yet, like, you need to recognize what you have in Jack Campbell and sort of, like, it's pro sports. It's not a, you know, there's no sort of good feelings here, and yet he's a guy who sort of relies on them. And I don't think he's a guy you can leave on the bench for too long. Like, again, especially at this point in the season, especially where we are in terms of, you know, desperation levels. I don't know that you, I just don't know you're at the point where you can park him for long periods of time, even if the other guy is playing significantly better. And it is significantly. Like, it's, you know, Skinner's numbers are sort of flirting with top 10 in the league when we look at adjusted numbers. And Campbell's adjusted save percentage is down there in the bottom three. So this isn't a small margin. This is significant. The good news if you're Jack Campbell is you've got company in the Pacific Division. He's bottom five. Cal Peterson's down there. Thatcher Demko's down there. Like, it's Jacob Markstrom's down there. So a lot of guys that, you know, again, for all the questions I had about the signing, and I've talked about it before, like, he's just right around the league expected in terms of performance relative to shot quality. He's better than he has been this season. And for some reason in the Pacific Division, he's certainly not alone when it comes to playing well below the expectations we've set for these guys. Jonathan Quick, -1.5%. Like, I look around the Pacific Division, and other than maybe Vegas, you know, out of the bottom 11 out of, say, 60 goalies that have played 100 and more games, nothing like counting on the air, but like 6 or 7 of them are in the Pacific Division. So Campbell's got company in that regard. I don't know that that takes any burden off him personally.
No.
But he's certainly not the only one struggling at this point, especially for some reason. Like I said, maybe the division's just overrated, and when they get outside of it, teams are that much better. I don't know that there's enough of a sample size to say that, but relative to the rest of the league, nobody's goalies are struggling more than the ones that are making big money in the Pacific right now.
Kevin Woodley from Ingo Magazine and NHL.com joins. Like, what's up with Demko? Is he hurt?
You know, I think I saw actually, you know, your DFO rundown partner, Frank Cervelli, tweeted something earlier today about that. I mean, I've talked about the off-season surgery that he had. I know what it was. I've seen some speculation out there on social media, especially that this is a reoccurrence of the hip injury. He had hip surgery when he was in college. Thatcher, like, doesn't want to share publicly what it was, and I think you have to respect that when it's medical. And all I can say is it has nothing to do with the hip. I don't know if it's bugging him still. For sure, part of this is environment. Bottom five in the National Hockey League in terms of what's going on in front of him. The Canucks' inability to shut down lateral plays and seam passes has left him almost looking like he's second-guessing his decisions. Like, he just doesn't know. You know, I've talked about this before. Even teams that give up a ton of high danger, like Vancouver, Vegas used to be one of these for sure before the coaching change when they were under Pete DeBoer. They would give up a ton, but the goalies could trust where they would come from. You can give up a ton, or you can give up high quality, but if they come from specific areas and the goalies can prepare for it, it's relatively simpler than a team that just gives them up all over the place and really doesn't take anything away from the opponents. And that's how the Canucks would play. That said, the environment wasn't much worse last year, and he outplayed it significantly. There are a bunch of guys playing behind environments that are this bad and still outplaying. Jake Allen's outplaying a similarly bad environment in Montreal right now. Demko is well below it. Like I said, looks unsure of his reads. He's had some tough bounces. He's made some mistakes. It's felt like every read mistake he makes ends up in the back of the net. But I'm also seeing some things in his setup and his lateral movement that are becoming problematic, especially on east-west plays. Like, he's getting killed on slot line plays that go across the ice from one side to the other below the top of the circles. And he's getting killed on broken plays that bounce off a stick or a skate or a leg on their way to the net, especially high danger. And when I look at how he moves laterally, so two things on the slot line, the east-west. Off the rush, uncharacteristically playing with backwards flow and starting out aggressively. Not all the time, but almost inconsistently, and getting caught where, like, he's just missing on a backdoor one-timer off the rush, or cross-ice one-timer, not backdoor. What's interesting to me is, like, there's been a bunch where he's been just almost there and not quite able to get there. Like, we're talking like inches. And when I look at where he started out from, you hear a lot of times, and we'll hear it on the broadcast with Canucks broadcast, Demko didn't have a chance on that one. And if you rewind it and you look at where he's playing it, you're like, nah, I don't know. Did he not have a chance, or did he not give himself a chance? You come out 2 feet past your crease and that play goes across the other side of the ice, that's, you know, 3 to 4 feet more you have to travel to get across to the opposite angle and be set and be square, or to get there at all to take up space. And the number of times it seems deliberate at this point, this is no longer a coincidence. Yes, your defenseman is supposed to prevent the pass on two-on-ones, but teams seem to be deliberately looking for it higher in the zone and shooting from higher in the zone and scoring from higher in the zone, because he's caught outside the blue ice, out in the white, when that pass is made, and he can't regain that depth. And part of it is tactical, making that decision to be out that far out before the pass is made. And part of it is technical. Like, I see a lot of just opening and closing in his movements, big blind pushes, and that's where he's getting killed on the broken plays. There was one last night that he actually kept out, but you could actually see the puck was going lateral. It hit a skate and came towards him, and he was on his heels. He had opened up in his movement. You hear me talk a lot about the Oilers and Skinner and working on that sort of top-down movement, keeping the head on top of the puck as you go east-west. His head is coming up and off over the shoulder, and everything is big, exaggerated movements. And for a guy who was almost never behind the play last year, always, like, pace was never an issue. All of a sudden, it looks like pace is a bit of an issue at times, and that makes me wonder about the injury. But there's other times where just the sort of way he moves is costing him, especially, like I said, on east-west and broken plays. Because you're not actually you're not really seeing the puck. You're pushing to where you think it's headed. And there's a lot of open and close in that for him. And if it doesn't end up where you think it was headed, you can get caught not seeing the deflection. Or if you're in the process of opening before you push, it's really hard to get back closed and shut down. He's had a bunch of pucks go through him. All things that were uncharacteristic last year.
Kevin Woodley from Ingo Magazine and NHL.com joins us. Kevin, Roberto Luongo, I would say out of the four guys going in, I thought he was the most deserving. And as you know, I'm more of a skater guy. I think there's arguments for the other guys. Like Alex McGillney is better than the Sinins or Alfredson. I'll say that all day, every day. But Luongo was pretty unique. What made him so special from a goaltending perspective in your eyes?
You know, a couple of things. Consistent, excellent. 919 average save percentage. I think if you filter it for guys that have played over 500 games, the only guys that are better are, you know, career-wise are Hasek and Rask. There's a few guys like Dryden and Tim Thomas. You could probably make an argument for two. But, not, you know, again, not first ballot, obviously, that are slightly ahead of him. But it wasn't just that he maintained the 919. Like, he played for 19 seasons, and I think other than his first year, which was with the Islanders, he only played, you know, parts of it, and then the last year where the injuries just came too much. So in the 17 seasons between the first and the last, he dipped below 915 three times. And two of them were related to coming out of lockouts where he just couldn't get going as quickly as he would have liked. One was a shortened season. Like, just his peaks, he had 3 years that were like, I think his best was Florida, 03, 04, 931, 2010, 11, he was 928. And then in 2017-18 with Florida again, he was 929. Like, those were his best. There was just a level of consistent excellence in there. And the fact that his best were scattered throughout his career, 03, 04, 10, 11, 17, 18, throughout such a long career, that was a credit to his willingness to adjust and adapt and make changes in his game. He never stopped working, Jason. And you could see it on a day-by-day basis here in Vancouver. I was lucky enough to go to Florida in August, late in his career, to spend a week with him and Robbie Tallis on and off the ice and to watch what he put himself through just to be able to get on the ice in August to go through his skating and get ready for a season. It was like an hour and a half to an hour 45. Of warm-up and stretching to get the hips and the groin to a point where he knew he wouldn't, you know, be going out there and risking injury. So the dedication to the craft, willingness to change his game as the game evolved around him. I mean, yeah, there was one summer where I remember it was, I think, 2013, the Sharks kind of started to exploit the way he was playing the post in the playoffs. He had Roberto, like, you watch him tonight at the Hall of Fame induction, he looked like he just got off a, you know, 6-hour cattle drive. Like, he's got a little bit of bow legging in him. And so when he would use what we call VH, sort of one pad up against the post and the back pad dropped above the goal line, he had a real tough time holding that back pad against the goal line or above it. And so teams were just stuffing it against that back pad and driving the net and trying to jam it in. When he was introduced to the reverse VH in that off season, he actually went and sought out a former coach, spent all summer working on it, and then brought it back to Vancouver where Roland Monson wasn't even teaching it and said, listen, here's the video. This is how I'm doing it. This is how we're doing it. And just basically added to his game and basically told the goalie coach, hey, let's work on this together. I know we haven't taught it here yet, but this is how we're going to do it. And it was a game changer for him in terms of how he handled sharp angle plays. And so just one example, when he broke the bone in his shoulder, obviously the famous game where he went to the hospital, then came back in, because Al Montoya had gotten hurt and they were out of goalies. in his rehab from that, he tried a composite stick just because it was lighter. He could go through the skating motions, realized that would make him better, switched his skates in his final 2 years of his career to get a better edge. Like, he was always looking for ways to get better. And I think there's an element, talking to Francois Allaire, like, there's an element to that in Patrick Waugh, that drive to be the number one guy that you need to sort of have a career as long as he did as a number one, and that willingness to constantly adapt your game. Those are, to me, are the things that stood out for Roberto Luongo, and why he's a first, not just a Hall of Famer, but I think first ballot was important. I mean, one of three guys to play 1,000 games. The stat that gets overlooked, and I was secretly, as listen, I'm a fan. I got to know him, and he was a guy that sort of inspired me to become a goalie here in Vancouver. The one I was hoping he would get that gets overlooked a lot, he finished his career a little more than 500 saves short of Martin Brodeur for the most saves in the history of the game. He finished second on that list, and that's a testament to the longevity as well as the absolutely terrible teams he played behind, not just early the first stint in Florida, but when he arrived in Vancouver, as Alain Vigneault used to say on a lot of nights, the whole strategy was come on, Lou. And for a lot of nights, for a lot of years, he held up his end of that strategy very well.
Next week, I want to get into a goalie conversation about, because today should be all about who's in the Hall of Fame. But next week, I want to talk about Curtis Joseph and someone else that you think should be in the Hall of Fame. We'll get to that next Monday. Kev, great stuff, buddy. We'll talk to you then.
Perfect. Thanks, Jason. Enjoy the I know Canucks fans, well, maybe not so much there in Edmonton, but out here, I think people will be enjoying this Hall of Fame celebration. We don't have a lot in this franchise in Vancouver to celebrate, but these three are certainly high on that list.